Jump out, kids. I'm going to babysit you. The dog's going on by himself. He turned to Rusty. Take the van, but drive slow. And stop the second the radiation count gets too high to be safe. Or if you start to feel woozy, we'll walk behind you.
Be careful, Mr. Everett, Joe said.
Benny added, Don't worry if you pass out and Wilson the van. We'll push you back under the road when you come to.
Thanks, Rusty said. You're all heart and a mile wide.
Huh?
Never mind. Rusty got behind the wheel and closed the driver's side door. On the passenger bucket, the Geiger counter clicked. He drove, very slowly, out of the woods. Up ahead, Black Ridge Road rose toward the orchard. At first he didn't see anything out of the ordinary, and had a moment of bone-deep disappointment. Then a bright purple flash hit him in the eyes, and he jammed on the brakes in a hurry. Something up there, all right. A bright something amid the scrabble of untended apple trees. Just behind him, in the van's outside mirror, he saw the other stop walking.
Rusty, Romy called. Okay?
I see it.
He counted to 15 and the purple light flashed again. He was reaching for the Geiger counter when Joe looked in at him through the driver's side window. The new pimples stood out on his skin like stigmata.
Do you feel anything woozy, swimmy in the head?
No, Rusty said. Joe pointed ahead.
That's where we blacked out, right there.
Rusty could see scuff marks in the dirt at the left side of the road. Walk that far, Rusty said, all four of you. Let's see if you pass out again.
Jesus, Benny said, joining Joe. What am I, a guinea pig?
Actually, I think Romy's the guinea pig. You up for it, Romy?
Yeah.
He turned to the kids. If I pass out and you don't, drag me back here.
It seems to be out of range.
The quartet walked to the scuff marks, Rusty watching intently from behind the wheel of the van. They had almost reached them when Romy first slowed, then staggered. Nori and Benny reached out on one side to steady him, Joe on the other. But Romy didn't fall. After a moment, he straightened up again.
Don't know if it was something real or only... what you call it, the power of suggestion, but I'm okay now. Was just a little lightheaded for a second, me. You kids feel anything?
They shook their heads. Rusty wasn't surprised. It was like chicken pox, a mild sickness mostly suffered by children, who only caught it once.
Drive ahead, Doc, Romy said. You don't want to be carrying all those pieces of lead sheet up there if you don't have to, but be careful.
Rusty drove slowly forward. He heard the accelerating pace of clicks from the Geiger counter, but felt absolutely nothing out of the ordinary. From the ridge, the light flashed out at 15-second intervals. He reached Romy and the children, then passed them.
I don't feel anything, he began.
And then it came. Not lightheadedness exactly, but a sense of strangeness and peculiar clarity. While it lasted, he felt as if his head were a telescope and he could see anything he wanted to see, no matter how far. He could see his brother making his morning commute in San Diego if he wanted to. Somewhere, in an adjacent universe, he heard Benny call out,
Whoa, Dr. Rusty's losing it.
But he wasn't. He could still see the dirt road perfectly well, divinely well. Every stone and chip of mica. If he had swerved, and he supposed he had, it was to avoid the man who was suddenly standing there. The man was skinny, and made taller by an absurd red, white, and blue stovepipe hat. Comically crooked. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt that read, Sweet Home, Alabama, play that dead band song. That's not a man, it's a Halloween dummy. Yes, sure, what else could it be? With green garden trowels for hands and a burlap head and stitched white crosses for eyes.
Doc, Doc!
It was Romy. The Halloween dummy burst into flames. A moment later it was gone. Now there was just the road, the ridge, and the purple light flashing at 15-second intervals, seeming to say, Come on. Come on. Come on. 12. Romy pulled open the driver's door.
Doc, Rusty, you okay?
Fine. It came, it went. I assume it was the same for you. Romy, did you see anything?
No, for a minute I thought I smelled fire. But I think that's because the air smells so smoky.
I saw a bonfire of burning pumpkins, Joe said. I told you that, right?
Yes.
Rusty hadn't attached enough significance to it in spite of what he'd heard from his own daughter's mouth. Now, he did.
I heard screaming, Benny said, but I forget the rest.
I heard it too, Nori said. It was daytime, but still dark. There was that screaming. And I think there was soot falling on my face.
Duck, maybe we better go back, Romy said.
Isn't gonna happen, Rusty said. Not if there's a chance I can get my kids and everyone else's kids out of here.
Bet some adults would like to go too, Benny remarked.
Joe threw him an elbow. Rusty looked at the Geiger counter. The needle was pegged on +200.
Stay here, he said.
Doc, Joe said, what if the radiation gets heavy and you pass out? What do we do then?
Rusty considered this.
If I'm still close, drag me out of there.
But not you, Nori, only the guys.
Why not me?
She asked.
Because you might like to have kids someday. Ones with only two eyes and all the limbs attached in the right places.
Right, I'm totally here, Nori said.
For the rest of you, short-term exposure should be okay. But I mean very short-term. If I should go down halfway up the ridge or actually in the orchard, leave me.
That's harsh, Doc.
I don't mean for good, Rusty said. You've got more lead roll back at the store, don't you? Yeah, we should have brought it. I agree, but you can't think of everything.
If worse comes to worse, get the rest of the lead roll, stick pieces in the windows of whatever you're driving and scoop me up. Hell, by then I might be on my feet again and walking toward town.
Yeah, while still laying knocked out and getting a lethal dose.
Look, Romy, we're probably worrying about nothing. I think the wooziness, the actual passing out if you're a kid, is like the other dome-related phenomena. You feel it once, then you're okay.
You could be betting your life on that. We've got to start placing bets at some point.
Good luck,
Joe said, and extended his fist through the window. Rusty pounded it lightly, then did the same with Nori and Benny. Romy also extended his fist.
What's good for the kids is good enough for me.
13. 20 yards beyond the place where Rusty had had the vision of the dummy in the stovepipe hat, the clicks from the Geiger counter mounted to a staticky roar. He saw the needle standing at +400, just into the red. He pulled over and hauled out gear he would have preferred not to put on. He looked back at the others.
A word of warning, he said, and I'm talking to you in particular, Mr. Benny Drake. If you laugh, you're walking home.
I won't laugh, Benny said, but in short order they were all laughing, including Rusty himself.
He took off his jeans, then pulled a pair of football practice pants up over his undershorts. Where pads on the thighs and buttocks should have gone, he stuffed pre-cut pieces of lead roll. Then he donned a pair of catcher's shin guards and curved more lead roll over them. This was followed by a lead collar to shield his thyroid gland and a lead apron to shield his testes. It was the biggest one they had and hung all the way down to the bright orange shin guards. He had considered hanging another apron over his back. Looking ridiculous was better than dying of lung cancer in his view, and had decided against it. He had already pushed his weight to over 300 pounds, and radiation didn't curve. If he faced the source, he thought he'd be okay. Well, maybe. To this point, Romy and the kids had managed to restrict themselves to discreet chuckles and a few strangulated giggles. Control wavered when Rusty stuffed a size extra-large bathing cap with two pieces of lead roll and pulled it down over his head. But it wasn't until he yanked on the elbow-length gloves and added the goggles that they lost it entirely.
It lives,
Benny cried, striding around with his arms outstretched like Frankenstein's monster.
Master, it lives!
Romy staggered to the side of the road and sat on a rock, bellowing with laughter. Joe and Nori collapsed on the road itself, rolling around like chickens taking a dust bath.
Walking home, every one of you, Rusty said, but he was smiling as he climbed,
not without difficulty, back into the van. Ahead of him, the purple light flashed out like a beacon. 14. Henry Morrison left the PD when the raucous locker room at halftime banter of the new recruits finally became too much to bear. It was going wrong, all of it. He supposed he'd known that even before Thibodeau, the thug who was now guarding Selectman Rennie, showed up with a signed order to can Jackie Weddington, a fine officer and an even finer woman. Henry regarded this as the first move in what would probably be a comprehensive effort to remove the older officers, the ones Rennie would see as Duke Perkins partisans from the force. He himself would be next. Freddie Denton and Rupert Libby would probably stay. Rup was a moderate asshole, Denton severe. Linda Everett would go, probably Stacy Moggin, too. Then, except for that dim-bulb Lauren Connery, the Chester's Mill PD would be an all-boys club again. He cruised slowly down Main Street, which was almost entirely empty, like a ghost town street in a western. Sloppy Sam Verdreau was sitting under the marquee of the Globe, and that bottle between his knees probably did not contain Pepsi-Cola. But Henry didn't stop. Let the old sot have his tipple. Johnny and Carrie Carver were boarding up the front windows at the gas and grocery. They were both wearing the blue armbands that had started to pop up all over town. They gave Henry the creeps. He wished he'd taken the slot in the Orono Police when it had been offered the previous year. It wasn't a step up career-wise, and he knew college kids could be shits to deal with when drunk or stoned. But the money was better, and Frieda said the Orono schools were top of the line. In the end, though, Duke had persuaded him to stay by promising to ram through a $5,000 raise at the next town meeting and by telling Henry, in absolute confidence, that he was going to fire Peter Randolph if Randolph wouldn't retire voluntarily. "You'd move up to APC, and that's another $10,000 a year," Duke had said. "When I retire, you can move all the way up to the top job if you want to. The alternative, of course, is driving UMO kids with puke drying on their pants back to their dorms. Tinker over." It had sounded good to him. It had sounded good, well, fairly good, to Frieda. And of course it relieved the kids, who had hated the idea of moving. Only now Duke was dead, Chester's Mill was under the dome, and the PD was turning into something that felt bad and smelled worse. He turned onto Prestille Street and saw Junior standing outside the yellow police tape strung around the McCain house. Junior was wearing pajama pants and slippers and nothing else. He was swaying, noticeably. And Henry's first thought was that Junior and Sloppy Sam had a lot in common today. His second thought was of and for the PD. He might not be a part of it for much longer, but he was now, and one of Duke Perkins' firmest rules had been, "Never let me see the name of a Chester's Mill PD officer in the Democrats' court beat column." And Junior, whether Henry liked it or not, was an officer. He pulled Unit 3 to the curb and went to where Junior was rocking back and forth. "Hey, Junes, let's get you back to the station, pour some coffee into you, and sober you up," was how he intended to finish this. But then he observed that the kid's pajama pants were soaked. Junior had pissed himself. Alarmed as well as disgusted, "No one must see this. Duke would spin in his grave." Henry reached out and grasped Junior's shoulder. "Come on, son. You're making a spectacle of yourself."
"They were my ghoul friends," Junior said without turning.
He rocked faster. His face, what Henry could see of it, was dreamy and rapt.
"I shilled them so I could fill them. No gooby French."
He laughed, then spat, or tried to. A thick white string hung down from his chin, swinging like a pendulum. "That's enough. I'm taking you home." This time Junior turned, and Henry saw he wasn't drunk. His left eye was bright red. Its pupil was too big. The left side of his mouth was pulled down, exposing some of his teeth. That frozen glare made Henry think momentarily of Mr. Sardonicus, a movie that had scared him as a kid. Junior didn't need to go to the station for coffee, and he didn't need to go home to sleep it off. Junior needed to go to the hospital. "Come on, kid," he said. "Walk." At first, Junior seemed willing enough. Henry escorted him most of the way to the car before Junior stopped again.
"They smelled alike, and I liked it," he said. "Hurry, hurry. Harry,
The snow is about to start.
Right. Absolutely. Henry had hoped to get Junior around the hood of the cruiser and into the front seat, but now this seemed impractical. The rear would have to do, even though the back seats of their cruisers usually smelled pretty fragrant. Junior looked back over his shoulder at the McCain house, and an expression of longing came over his partially frozen face.
Girlfriend,
Junior cried.
Extendable. No gooby. French. Oh, French, you fumnuck.
He stuck out his tongue and flapped it rapidly against his lips. The noise was similar to the one Roadrunner makes before speeding away from Wile E. Coyote in a cloud of dust. Then he laughed and started back to the house.
No, Junior, Henry said and grabbed him by the waistband of his pajama pants.
We have to... Junior wheeled around with surprising speed. No laughter now. His face was a twitching cat's cradle of hate and rage. He rushed at Henry, flailing his fists. He stuck out his tongue and bit it with his champing teeth. He was gobbling in some strange language that seemed to have no vowels. Henry did the only thing he could think of. Stood aside. Junior plunged past him and began to hammer punches at the jackpot lights on top of the cruiser, smashing one of them and lacerating his knuckles. Now people were coming out of their houses to see what was happening. Junior raved. One foot slipped off the curb and into the gutter. He staggered but kept his feet. There was blood as well as spit hanging from his chin now. Both hands were badly cut and dripping.
She just made me so fretting mad,
Junior screamed.
I hit her with my knee to shut her up. She threw a tit. Shit everywhere I...
He quit. Appeared to consider. Said,
I need help.
Then popped his lips. The sound as loud as the report of a .22 pistol in the still air, and fell forward between the parked police car and the sidewalk. Henry drove him to the hospital using lights and siren. What he didn't do was think about the last things Junior had said. Things that almost made sense. He wouldn't go there. He had problems enough. 15. Rusty drove slowly up Black Ridge, looking frequently at the Geiger counter, which was now roaring like an AM radio set between stations. The needle rose from plus 400 to the plus 1K mark. Rusty was betting it would be swung all the way over to the plus 4K post by the time he topped the ridge. He knew this couldn't be good news. His radiation suit was makeshift at best, but he kept going, reminding himself that rads were cumulative. If he moved fast, he wouldn't pick up a lethal dose. I might temporarily lose some hair, but no way I'll get a lethal dose. Think of it as a bombing run. Get in, do your business, and get back out again. He turned on the radio, got the Mighty Clouds of Joy on WCIK, and immediately turned it off again. Sweat rolled into his eyes, and he blinked it away. Even with the air conditioner blasting, it was devilishly hot in the van. He looked into the rearview mirror and saw his fellow explorers clustered together. They looked very small. The roaring from the Geiger counter quit. He looked. The needle had dropped back to zero. Rusty almost stopped, then realized if he did, Romy and the kids would think he was in trouble. Besides, it was probably just the battery. But when he looked again, he saw that the power lamp was still glowing brightly. At the top of the hill, the road ended in a turnaround in front of a long red barn. An old truck and an even older tractor stood in front of it, the tractor leaning on a single wheel. The barn looked to be in pretty good condition, although some of the windows were broken. Behind it stood a deserted farmhouse, with part of the roof crushed in, probably by the weight of winter snow. The end of the barn was standing open, and even with the windows shut and the air conditioning running full tilt, Rusty could smell the cidery aroma of old apples. He stopped next to the steps leading up to the house. There was a chain across these with a sign hanging from it. Trespassers will be prosecuted. The sign was old, rusty, and obviously ineffective. Beer cans were scattered the length of the porch where the McCoy family must once have sat on summer evenings, catching the breeze and looking over long vistas. The entire town of Chester's Mill to the right. All the way into New Hampshire if you looked left. Someone had spray-painted Wildcats Rule on a wall that had once been red
and was now a faded pink. On the door, in spray paint of a different color, was Orgy Depot. Rusty guessed that was wishful thinking on the part of some sex-starved teenager. Or maybe it was the name of a heavy metal band. He picked up the Geiger counter and tapped it. The needle jumped, and the instrument clucked a few times. It seemed to be working fine. It just wasn't picking up any major radiation. He got out of the van and, after a brief interior debate, stripped off most of his makeshift shielding, leaving only the apron, gloves, and goggles. Then he walked down the length of the barn, holding the sensor tube of the Geiger counter out in front of him, and promising himself he'd go back for the rest of his suit the second the needle jumped. But when he emerged from the side of the barn, and the light flashed out no more than 40 yards away, the needle didn't stir. It seemed impossible. If, that was, the radiation was related to the light. Rusty could think of only one possible explanation. The generator had created a radiation belt to discourage explorers such as himself. To protect itself. The same could be true of the lightheadedness he'd felt. Actual unconsciousness in the case of the kids. Protection. Like a porcupine's quills. Or a skunk's perfume. Isn't it more likely that the counter's malfunctioning? You could be giving yourself a lethal dose of gamma rays at this very second. The damn thing's a Cold War relic. But as he approached the edge of the orchard, Rusty saw a squirrel dart through the grass and run up one of the trees. It paused on a branch weighted down with unpicked fruit and stared at the two-legged intruder below, its eyes bright, its tail bushed out. To Rusty, it looked fine as fiddlesticks, and he saw no animal corpses in the grass or on the overgrown lanes between the trees, no suicides, and no probable radiation victims either. Now he was very close to the light. Its time flash is so brilliant that he squeezed his eyes nearly shut each time it came. To his right, the whole world seemed to lie at his feet. He could see the town, toy-like and perfect, 4 miles away. The grid of the streets, the steeple of the Congo Church, the twinkle of a few cars on the move. He could see the low brick structure of Catherine Russell Hospital, and far to the west, the black smudge where the missiles had struck. It hung there, a beauty mark on the cheek of the day. The sky overhead was a faded blue, almost its normal color, but at the horizon, the blue became a poison yellow. He felt quite sure some of that color had been caused by pollution, the same crap that had turned the stars pink. But he suspected most of it was nothing more sinister than autumn pollen sticking to the dome's unseen surface. He got moving again. The longer he was up here, especially up here and out of view, the more nervous his friends would become. He wanted to go directly to the source of the light, but first he walked out of the orchard and to the edge of the slope. From here, he could see the others, although they were little more than specks. He set the Geiger counter down, then waved both hands slowly back and forth over his head to show he was okay. They waved back. Okay, he said. Inside the heavy gloves, his hands were slick with sweat. Let's see what we've got here. 16. It was snack time at East Street Grammar School. Judy and Janelle Everett sat at the far end of the play yard with their friend Deanna Carver, who was 6, thus fitting neatly between the little Jays, age-wise. Deanna was wearing a small blue armband around the left sleeve of her t-shirt. She had insisted that Carrie tie it on her before she went to school, so she could be like her parents.
What's it for?
Janelle asked.
It means I like the police,
Deanna said, and munched on her fruit roll-up.
I want one,
Judy said.
Only yellow.
She pronounced this word very carefully. Back when she was a baby, she said lello, and Jenny had laughed at her.
They can't be yellow, Deanna said. Only blue. This roll-up is good. I wish I had a billion. You'd get fat,
Janelle said.
You'd bust.
They giggled at this, then fell silent for a little while and watched the bigger kids, the Jays nibbling on their homemade peanut butter crackers. Some girls were playing hopscotch. Boys were climbing on the monkey bars, and Miss Goldstone was pushing the Pruitt twins on the swing glider. Mrs. Vandesteen had organized a kickball game. It all looked pretty normal, Janelle thought. But it wasn't normal. Nobody was shouting. Nobody was wailing with a scraped knee. Mindy and Mandy Pruitt weren't begging Miss Goldstone to admire their matching hairdos. They all looked like they were just pretending snack time. Even the grown-ups. And everyone, including her, kept stealing glances up at the sky. Which should have been blue, and wasn't. Quite. None of that was the worst, though. The worst, ever since the seizures, was the suffocating certainty that something bad was going to happen. Deanna said,
I was going to be the Little Mermaid on Halloween, but now I ain't. I ain't going to be nothing. I don't want to go out. I'm scared of Halloween.
Did you have a bad dream?
Janelle asked.
Yes.
Deanna held out her fruit roll-up.
Do you want the rest of this? I ain't so hungry as I thought.
No,
Janelle said. She didn't even want the rest of her peanut butter crackers, and that wasn't a bit like her. And Judy had eaten just half a cracker. Janelle remembered once how she'd seen Audrey corner a mouse in their garage. She remembered how Audrey had barked and lunged at the mouse when it tried to scurry from the corner it was in. That had made her feel sad, and she called her mother to take Audrey away so she wouldn't eat the mousie. Mummy laughed, but she did it. Now they were the mice. Janie had forgotten most of the dreams she'd had during the seizures, but still she knew this much. Now they were the ones in the corner.
I'm just going to stay home,
Deanna said. A tear stood in her left eye, bright and clear and perfect.
Stay home, all Halloween. Ain't even coming to school. Won't, can't nobody make me.
Mrs. Van de Steen left the kickball game and began ringing the all-in bell, but none of the three girls stood up at first.
It's Halloween already, Judy said. Look.
She pointed across the street to where a pumpkin stood on the porch of the Wheeler's house.
And look.
This time she pointed to a pair of cardboard ghosts flanking the post office doors.
And look.
This last time, she pointed at the library lawn. Here was a stuffed dummy that had been put up by Lissa Jameson. She had undoubtedly meant it to be amusing. But what amuses adults often scares children. And Janelle had an idea the dummy on the library lawn might be back to visit her that night, while she was lying in the dark and waiting to go to sleep. The head was burlap with eyes that were white crosses made from thread. The hat was like the one the cat wore in the Dr. Seuss story. It had garden trowels for hands. Bad old, clutchy, grabby hands, Janelle thought. And a shirt with something written on it. She didn't understand what it meant, but she could read the words. Sweet, home, Alabama, play, that dead band song.
See?
Judy wasn't crying. But her eyes were wide and solemn, full of some knowledge too complex and too dark to be expressed.
Halloween already.
Janelle took her sister's hand and pulled her to her feet.
Though it's not, she said.
But she was afraid it was. Something bad was going to happen. Something with a fire in it. No treats. Only tricks. Mean tricks. Bad tricks.
Let's go inside,
she told Judy and Deanna.
We'll sing songs and stuff. That'll be nice.
It usually was, but not that day. Even before the big bang in the sky, it wasn't nice. Janelle kept thinking about the dummy with the white cross eyes and the somehow awful shirt. Play that dead band song. 17. 4 years before the dome dropped down, Linda Everett's grandfather had died and left each of his grandchildren a small but tidy sum of money. Linda's check had come to $17,232.04. Most of it went into the Jay's College Fund, but she had felt more than justified in spending a few hundred on Rusty. His birthday was coming up and he'd wanted an Apple TV gadget since they'd come on the market some years earlier. She had bought him more expensive presents during the course of their marriage, but never one which pleased him more. The idea that he could download movies from the net, then watch them on TV instead of being chained to the smaller screen of his computer, tickled him to death. The gadget was a white plastic square about 7 inches on a side, and 3/4 of an inch thick. The object Rusty found on Black Ridge looked so much like his Apple TV add-on that he at first thought it actually was one. Only modified, of course, so it could hold an entire town prisoner, as well as broadcast The Little Mermaid to your television via Wi-Fi and in HD. The thing on the edge of the McCoy orchard was dark gray instead of white. And rather than the familiar Apple logo stamped on top of it, Rusty observed a somehow troubling symbol, like a comma, with 2 diagonal slashes running across it. Above the symbol was a hooded excrescence, about the size of the knuckle on his little finger. Inside the hood was a lens made of either glass or crystal. It was from this that the spaced purple flashes were coming. Rusty bent and touched the surface of the generator. If it was a generator. A strong shock immediately surged up his arm and through his body. He tried to pull back and couldn't. His muscles were locked up tight. The Geiger counter gave a single bray, then fell silent. Rusty had no idea whether or not the needle swung into the danger zone, because he couldn't move his eyes either. The light was leaving the world, funneling out of it like water going down a bathtub drain, and he thought with sudden calm clarity, I'm going to die. What a stupid way to... Then, in that darkness, faces arose. Only they weren't human faces. And later he would not be sure they were faces at all. They were geometric solids that seemed to be padded in leather. The only parts of them that looked even vaguely human were diamond shapes on the sides. They could have been ears. The heads, if they were heads, turned to each other either in discussion or something that could have been mistaken for it. He thought he heard laughter. He thought he sensed excitement. He pictured children in the play yard at East Street Grammar, his girls, perhaps, and their friend Deanna Carver, exchanging snacks and secrets at recess. All of this happened in a space of seconds, surely no more than 4 or 5. Then it was gone. The shock dissipated as suddenly and completely as it did when people first touched the surface of the dome. As quickly as his lightheadedness, and the accompanying vision of the dummy in the crooked top hat. He was just kneeling at the top of the ridge, overlooking the town, and sweltering in his leaden accessories. Yet the image of those leather heads remained, leaning together and laughing an obscenely childish conspiracy. The others are down there watching me. Wave, show them you're all right. He raised both hands over his head. Now they move smoothly, and waved them slowly back and forth, just as if his heart were not pounding like a jackrabbit in his chest. As if sweat weren't running down his chest in sharply aromatic rivulets. Below on the road, Romy and the kids waved back. Rusty took several deep breaths to calm himself, then held the Geiger counter sensor tube out to the flat gray square which sat on a spongy mat of grass. The needle wavered just below the +5 mark. A background count, no more. Rusty had little doubt that this flat square object was the source of their troubles. Creatures. Not human beings. Creatures. Were using it to keep them prisoner. But that wasn't all. They were also using it to observe. And having fun. The bastards were laughing. He had heard them. Rusty stripped off the apron, draped it over the box with its slightly protruding lens, got up, backed away. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the apron caught fire. The smell was pungent and nasty. He watched the shiny surface blister and bubble, watched the flames erupt. Then the apron, which was essentially no more than a plastic-coated sheet of lead, simply fell apart. For a moment there were burning pieces, the biggest one still lying on top of the box. A moment later the apron, or what remained of it, disintegrated. A few swirling bits of ash remained, and the smell. But otherwise, poof, gone. Did I see that? Rusty asked himself, then said it aloud, asking the world. He could smell roasted plastic, and a heavier smell that he supposed was smelted lead. Insane, impossible, but the apron was gone, nonetheless. Did I actually see that? As if in answer, the purple light flashed out of the hooded knuckle on top of the box. Were those pulses renewing the dome? The way the touch of a finger on a computer keyboard could refresh the screen? Were they allowing the Leatherheads to watch the town? Both? Neither? He told himself not to approach the flat square again. He told himself the smartest thing he could do would be to run back to the van. Without the weight of the apron, he could run. And then drive like hell, slowing only to pick up his companions waiting below. Instead, he approached the box again and dropped to his knees before it, a posture too much like worship for his liking. He stripped off one of the gloves, touched the ground beside the thing, then snatched his hand back, hot. Bits of burning apron had scorched some of the grass. Next, he reached for the box itself, steeling himself for another burn, or another shock, although neither was what he was most afraid of. He was afraid of seeing those leather shapes again, those not quite heads bent together in some laughing conspiracy. But there was nothing. No visions and no heat. The gray box was cool to the touch, even though he'd seen the lead apron on top of it bubbling up and then actually catching fire. The purple light flashed out. Rusty was careful not to put his hand in front of it. Instead, he gripped the thing's sides, mentally saying goodbye to his wife and girls, telling them he was sorry for being such a damn fool. He waited to catch fire and burn. When he didn't, he tried to lift the box. Although it had the surface area of a dinner plate and wasn't much thicker, he couldn't budge it. The box might as well have been welded to the top of a pillar planted in 90 feet of New England bedrock. Except it wasn't. It was sitting on top of a grassy mat. And when he wriggled his fingers deeper beneath, they touched. He laced them together and tried again to lift the thing. No shock, no visions, no heat, no movement either. Not so much as a wiggle. He thought, my hands are gripping some sort of alien artifact. A machine from another world. I may have even caught a glimpse of its operators. The idea was intellectually amazing, flabbergasting even. But it had no emotional gradient. Perhaps because he was too stunned, too overwhelmed with information that did not compute. So what next? Just what the hell next? He didn't know. And it seemed he wasn't emotionally flat after all, because a wave of despair rolled through him, and he was only just able to stop from vocalizing that despair in a cry. The four people down below might hear it and think he was in trouble. Which, of course, he was. Nor was he alone. He got to his feet, on legs that trembled and threatened to give out beneath him. The hot, close air seemed to lie on his skin like oil. He made his way slowly back toward the van through the apple-heavy trees. The only thing he was sure of was that under no circumstances could Big Jim Rennie learn of the generator. Not because he would try to destroy it, but because he'd very likely set a guard around it to make sure it wasn't destroyed. To make sure it kept right on doing what it was doing, so he could keep on doing what he was doing. For the time being, at least, Big Jim liked things just the way they were. Rusty opened the door of the van, and that was when, less than a mile north of Black Ridge, a huge explosion rocked the day. It was as if God had leaned down and fired a heavenly shotgun. Rusty shouted in surprise and looked up. He immediately shielded his eyes from the fierce temporary sun burning in the sky over the border between TR-90 and Chester's Mill. Another plane had crashed into the dome. Only this time, it had been no mere Seneca 5. Black smoke billowed up from the point of impact, which Rusty estimated at being at least 20,000 feet. If the black spot left by the missile strikes was a beauty mark on the cheek of the day, then this new mark was a skin tumor, one that had been allowed to run wild. Rusty forgot about the generator. He forgot about the four people waiting for him. He forgot about his own children, for whom he had just risked being burned alive and then discorporated. For a space of 2 minutes, there was no room for anything in his mind but black awe. Rubble was falling to earth on the other side of the dome. The smashed forward quarter of the jetliner was followed by a flaming motor. The motor was followed by a waterfall of blue airline seats, many with passengers still strapped into them.
The seats were followed by a vast, shining wing, seesawing like a sheet of paper in a draft. The wing was followed by the tail of what was probably a 767. The tail was painted dark green. A lighter green shape had been superimposed on it. It looked to Rusty like a clover. Not a clover, a shamrock. Then the body of the plane crashed to earth like a defective arrow and lit the woods on fire. 18. The blast rocks the town and they all come out to see. All over Chester's Mill they come out to see. They stand in front of their houses and driveways on sidewalks in the middle of Main Street. And although the sky north of their prison is mostly cloudy, they have to shield their eyes from the glare, what looked to Rusty from his place atop Black Ridge like a second sun. They see what it is, of course. The sharper-eyed among them can even read the name on the body of the plummeting plane before it disappears below the tree line. It is nothing supernatural. It has even happened before, and just this week, although on a smaller scale, admittedly. But in the people of Chester's Mill, it inspires a kind of sullen dread that will hold sway over the town from then until the end. Anyone who has ever cared for a terminal patient will tell you that there comes a tipping point when denial dies and acceptance finds its way in. For most people in Chester's Mill, the tipping point came at mid-morning on October 25th, while they stood either alone or with their neighbors, watching as more than 300 people plunged into the woods of TR-90. Earlier that morning, perhaps 15% of the town was wearing blue solidarity armbands. By sundown on this Wednesday in October, it will be twice that. When the sun comes up tomorrow, it will be over 50% of the population. Denial gives way to acceptance. Acceptance breeds dependence. Anyone who's ever cared for a terminal patient will tell you that, too. Sick people need someone who will bring them their pills and glasses of cold, sweet juice to wash them down with. They need someone to soothe their aching joints with arnica gel. They need someone to sit with them when the night is dark and the hours stretch out. They need someone to say, sleep now. It will be better in the morning. I'm here, so sleep, sleep now. Sleep, and let me take care of everything. Sleep. 19. Officer Henry Morrison got Junior to the hospital. By then the kid had regained a soupy semblance of consciousness, although he was still talking gibberish, and Twitch wheeled him away on a gurney. It was a relief to see him go. Henry got Big Jim's home and town hall office numbers from directory assistance, but there was no answer at either. They were landlines. He was listening to a robot tell him that James Rennie's cell phone number was unlisted when the jetliner exploded. He rushed out with everyone else who was ambulatory and stood in the turnaround, looking at the new black mark on the dome's invisible surface. The last of the debris was still fluttering down. Big Jim was indeed in his town hall office, but he had killed the phone so he could work on both speeches, the one to the cops tonight, the one to the entire town tomorrow night, without interruption. He heard the explosion and rushed outside. His first thought was that Cox had set off a nuke, a cotton-picking nuke. If it broke through the dome, it would ruin everything. He found himself standing next to Al Timmons, the town hall janitor. Al pointed north, high in the sky, where smoke was still rising. It looked to Big Jim like an anti-aircraft burst in an old World War II movie.
"It was an airplane!" Al shouted. "And a big one! Christ, didn't they get the word?"
Big Jim felt a cautious sense of relief, and his trip-hammering heart slowed a bit. If it was a plane, just a plane, and not a nuke or some kind of super-missile. His cell phone tweeted. He snatched it from the pocket of his suit coat and snapped it open.
"Peter, is that you?"
"No, Mr. Rennie, Colonel Cox here."
"What did you do?" Rennie shouted.
"What in God's name did you people do now?"
"Nothing."
There was none of the former crisp authority in Cox's voice. He sounded stunned.
"It was nothing to do with us. It was... Hold on a minute."
Rennie waited. Main Street was full of people staring up into the sky with their mouths gaped open. To Rennie, they looked like sheep dressed in human clothing. Tomorrow night, they would crowd into the town hall and go, "Ba, ba, ba. When'll it get better? And ba, ba, ba. Take care of us until it does." And he would.
not because he wanted to, but because it was God's will. Cox came back on. Now he sounded weary as well as stunned. Not the same man who had hectored Big Jim about stepping down. And that's the way I want you to sound, pal, Rennie thought. Exactly the way.
My initial information is that Air Ireland Flight 179 has struck the dome and exploded. It originated in Shannon and was bound for Boston. We already have two independent witnesses who claim to have seen a shamrock on the tail, and an ABC crew that was filming just outside the quarantine zone in Harlow may have gotten... One more second. It was much more than a second, more than a minute. Big Jim's heart had been slowing toward its normal speed, if 120 beats per minute can be so characterized. But now it sped up again and took one of those looping misbeats. He coughed and pounded at his chest. His heart seemed almost to settle, then went into a full-blown arrhythmia. He felt sweat pop on his brow. The day, formerly dull, all at once seemed too bright.
Jim?
It was Al Timmons, and although he was standing right beside Big Jim, his voice seemed to be coming from a galaxy far, far away.
You okay?
Fine, Big Jim said. Stay right there. I may want you.
Cox was back.
It was, indeed, the Aer Lingus flight. I just watched ABC's streamed footage of the crash. A reporter was doing a stand-up and it occurred right behind her. They caught the whole thing.
I'm sure their ratings will go up.
Mr. Rennie, we may have had our differences, but I hope you'll convey to your constituents that this is nothing for them to worry about.
Just tell me how a thing like that...
His heart looped again. His breath tore in, then stopped. He pounded his chest a second time, harder, and sat down on a bench beside the brick path which ran from the town hall to the sidewalk. Al was looking at him instead of at the crash scar on the dome now, his forehead furrowed with concern. And, Big Jim thought, fright. Even now, with all this happening, he was glad to see that, glad to know he was seen as indispensable. Sheep need a shepherd.
Rennie, are you there?
I'm here.
And so was his heart. But it was far from right.
How did it happen? How could it? I thought you people got the word out.
We're not positive and won't be until we recover the black box, but we've got a pretty good idea. We sent out a directive warning all commercial air carriers away from the dome, but this is 179's usual flight path. We think someone neglected to reprogram the autopilot. Simple as that. I'll get you further details as soon as we get them here, but right now the important thing is to quell any panic in town before it can take hold.
But under certain circumstances, panic could be good. Under certain circumstances, it could, like food riots and acts of arson, have a beneficial effect.
This was stupidity on a grand scale, but still just an accident,
Cox was saying.
Make sure your people know that.
They'll know what I tell them and believe what I want them to, Rennie thought. His heart skittered like grease on a hot griddle, settled briefly into a more normal rhythm, then skittered again. He pushed the red end call button without responding to Cox and dropped the phone back into his pocket. Then he looked at Al.
I need you to take me to the hospital, he said, speaking as calmly as he could manage. I seem to be in some discomfort here.
Al, who was wearing a solidarity armband, looked more alarmed than ever.
Of course, Jim. You just sit right there while I get my car. You can't let anything happen to you. The town needs you.
Don't I know it, Big Jim thought,
sitting on the bench and looking at the great black smear on the sky.
Find Carter Thibodeau and tell him to meet me there. I want him on hand.
There were other instructions he wanted to give, but just then, his heart stopped completely. For a moment, Forever yawned at his feet. A clear, dark chasm. Rennie gasped and pounded his chest. It burst into a full gallop. He thought at it, don't you quit on me now. I've got too much to do. Don't you dare, you cotton picker. Don't you dare. 20.
What was it?
Nori asked in a high, childish voice, and then answered her own question.
It was an airplane, wasn't it? An airplane full of people.
She burst into tears. The boys tried to hold their own tears back and couldn't. Romy felt like crying himself.
Yeah, he said. I think that's what it was.
Joe turned to look at the van now heading back toward them. When it got to the foot of the ridge, it sped up, as if Rusty couldn't wait to get back. When he arrived and jumped out, Joe saw he had another reason for hurry. The lead apron was gone. Before Rusty could say anything, his cell phone rang. He flipped it open, looked at the number, and took the call. He expected Ginny, but it was the new guy, Thurston Marshall.
Yes, what? If it's about the plane I saw...
He listened, frowning a little, then nodding.
Okay, yes, right, I'm coming now. Tell Ginny or Twitch to give him 2 milligrams of Valium IV push. No, better make it 3. And tell him to be calm. That's foreign to his nature, but tell him to try. Give his son 5 milligrams.
He closed his phone and looked at them. Both Rennies are in the hospital, the elder with heartbeat arrhythmia, which he's had before. The damn fool has needed a pacemaker for 2 years. Thurston says the younger has symptoms that look to him like a glioma. I hope he's wrong. Nori turned her tear-stained face up to Rusty's. She had her arm around Benny Drake, who was furiously wiping at his eyes. When Joe came and stood next to her, she put her other arm around him.
That's a brain tumor, right? She said. A bad one.
When they hit kids Junior Rennie's age, almost all of them are bad. What did you find up there? Romy asked.
And what happened to your apron?
Benny added.
I found what Joe thought I'd find. The generator, Romy said. Doc, are you sure? Yeah, it's like nothing I ever saw before. I'm pretty sure no one on Earth's seen anything like it before.
Something from another planet,
Joe said in a voice so low it was a whisper.
I knew.
Rusty looked at him hard. You can't talk about it. None of us can. If you're asked, say we looked and found nothing.
Even to my mom?
Joe asked plaintively. Rusty almost relented on that score. Then hardened his heart. This was a secret now shared among 5 people, and that was far too many. But the kids had deserved to know, and Joe McClatchy had guessed anyway.
Even her, at least for now.
I can't lie to her, Joe said. It doesn't work. She's got mom vision.
Then just say I swore you to secrecy, and it's better for her that way. If she presses, tell her to talk to me. Come on, I need to get back to the hospital. Romy, you drive. My nerves are shot.
Aren't you gonna... Romy began.
I'll tell you everything. On the way back.
Maybe we can even figure out what the hell to do about it.
21. An hour after the Aer Lingus 767 crashed into the dome, Rose Twitchell marched into the Chester's Mill PD with a napkin-covered plate. Stacy Moggin was back on the desk, looking as tired and distracted as Rose felt.
What's that? Stacy asked.
Lunch for my cook. 2 toasted BLTs.
Rose, I'm not supposed to let you down there. I'm not supposed to let anyone go down there.
Mel Searles had been talking with 2 of the new recruits about a monster truck show he'd seen at the Portland Civic Center last spring. Now, he looked around.
I'll take him to him, Ms. Twitchell.
You will not,
Rose said. Mel looked surprised and a little hurt. He had always liked Rose and thought she liked him.
I don't trust you not to drop the plate, she explained.
Although this wasn't the exact truth, the fact was she didn't trust him at all.
I watched you play football, Melvin.
Ah, come on, I ain't that clumsy.
Also, because I want to see if he's all right.
He's not supposed to have any visitors, Mel said. That's from Chief Randolph, and he got it direct from Selectman Rennie.
Well, I'm going down. You'll have to use your taser to stop me, and if you do that, I'll never make you another strawberry waffle the way you like them, with the batter all runny in the middle.
She looked around and sniffed.
Besides, I don't see either of those men here right now. Or am I missing something?
Mel considered getting tough, if only to impress the fresh fish, and then decided not to. He really did like Rose, and he liked her waffles, especially when they were a little gushy. He hitched up his belt and said,
Okay, but I have to go with you, and you ain't taking him nothing until I look under that napkin.
She raised it. Underneath were 2 BLTs and a note written on the back of a Sweetbriar Rose customer check. "Stay strong," it said. "We believe in you." Mel took the note, crumpled it, and threw it toward the wastebasket. It missed, and one of the recruits scurried to pick it up.
"Come on," he said,
then stopped, took half a sandwich, and tore out a monster bite.
"He couldn't eat all that anyway," he told Rose.
Rose said nothing, but as he led her downstairs, she did briefly consider braining him with the plate. She got halfway down the lower corridor before Mel said,
"That's as close as you go, Mrs. Twitchell. I'll take it the rest of the way."
She handed the plate over and watched unhappily as Mel knelt, pushed the plate through the bars, and announced,
"Lunch is served, Monsieur."
Barbie ignored him. He was looking at Rose. "Thank you. Although if Anson made those, I don't know how grateful I'll be after the first bite."
"I made them," she said.
"Bobby, why did they beat you up? Were you trying to get away? You look awful."
"Not trying to get away, resisting arrest. Wasn't I, Mel?"
"You want to quit the smart talk, or I'll come in there and take them sandwiches away from you."
"Well, you could try," Barbie said. "We could contest the matter." When Mel showed no inclination to take him up on this offer, Barbie turned his attention to Rose once more. "Was it an airplane? It sounded like an airplane, a big one."
"ABC says it was an Aer Lingus jetliner, fully loaded."
"Let me guess, it was on its way to Boston or New York, and some not-so-bright spark forgot to reprogram the autopilot."
"I don't know. They're not saying about that part yet."
"Come on," Mel came back and took her arm. "That's enough chitter-chatter. You need to leave before I get in trouble."
"Are you okay?"
Rose asked Barbie, resisting this command, at least for a moment.
"Yeah,"
Barbie said. "How about you? Did you patch it up with Jackie Weddington yet?" And what was the correct answer to that one? So far as Rose knew, she had nothing to patch up with Jackie. She thought she saw Barbie give a tiny shake of the head and hoped it wasn't just her imagination.
"Not yet," she said.
"You ought to. Tell her to stop being a bitch."
"As if," Mel muttered.
He locked onto Rose's arm.
"Come on now, don't make me drag you."
"Tell her I said you're all right," Barbie called, as she went up the stairs, this time leading the way with Mel at her heels.
"You two really should talk. And thanks for the sandwiches."
"Tell her I said you're all right." That was the message. She was quite sure of it. She didn't think Mel had caught it. He'd always been dull, and life under the dome did not seem to have smartened him up any, which was probably why Barbie had taken the risk. Rose made up her mind to find Jackie as soon as possible and pass on the message. "Barbie says I'm all right. Barbie says you can talk to me."
"Thank you, Mel," she said when they were back in the ready room. "It was kind of you to let me do that."
Mel looked around, saw no one of greater authority than himself, and relaxed.
"No problemo, but don't think you're getting down there again with supper, because it ain't happening."
He considered, then waxed philosophical.
"He deserves something nice, though, I guess, because come next week this time, he's going to be as toasty as those sandwiches you made him."
"We'll see about that," Rose thought. 22. Andy Sanders and the chef sat beside the WCIK storage barn smoking glass. Straight ahead of them, in the field surrounding the radio tower, was a mound of earth marked with a cross made out of crate slats. Beneath the mound lay Sammy Bushy, torturer of brats, rape victim, mother of little Walter. Chef said that later on he might steal a regular cross from the cemetery by Chester Pond, if there was time. There might not be. He lifted his garage door opener as if to emphasize this point. Andy felt sorry for Sammy, just as he felt sorry about Claudette and Dodie, but now it was a clinical sorrow, safely stored inside its own dome. You could see it, could appreciate its existence, but you couldn't exactly get in there with it, which was a good thing. He tried to explain this to Chef Bushy. Although he got a little lost in the middle, it was a complex concept. Chef nodded, though, then passed Andy a large glass bong. Etched on the side were the words, "Not legal for trade."
"Good, ain't it?" Chef said.
"Yes," Andy said.
For a little while then, they discussed the two great texts of born-again dopers. What good shit this was, and how fucked up they were getting on this good shit. At some point, there was a huge explosion to the north. Andy shielded his